Folks, we're about to get started. I want to welcome you to this webinar, which is jointly produced by the National Institute for Mathematical and Biological Synthesis and by the Ecological Society of America. We are going to spend the first few minutes doing a little bit of an introduction of ourselves, assuming that it will take a couple of minutes for everyone to come online. And then we will begin in about 3 or 4 minutes. So please also be aware that there is a resources page for this that was sent to you in the sign-up material. It is listed on this page as well. And the webinar archive will be posted there once we are done, along with the PowerPoint associated with this webinar. So the next step here is for me to say something about who I am. My name is Louis Gross. I am the director of the institute here, which is the National Institute for Mathematical and Biological Synthesis, which we typically call NIMBUS, being as we're in East Tennessee and we can slur our vowels. And the website is nimbios, nimbios.org. My training is in applied mathematics. My early work was on photosynthetic dynamics, and I work on a wide variety of different issues in applying mathematical and computational methods to ecological questions, including Everglades restoration problems through the ATLAS project, or cross trophic level system simulation, as well as a wide variety of applications to infectious disease, invasion biology, and many other areas related to ecology. And now we're going to move to our next leader of this webinar, and that's Will Godso, and he'll say something about himself.
Hi, so I'm Will Godso. I'm a postdoc here at NIMBUS, or NIMBIOS, depending on how you're reading it. I finished my doctorate from the University of Idaho, studying coevolution between yuccas and yuccamos in last year around this time. And originally my background was as an empirical ecologist, someone who wanted to go out and just look at very interesting things that are out in nature. But one of the things that I found as I went through my doctorate is that I was really interested in coming up with flaky ideas, and people only started to believe some of those ideas when I attached equations to them. And so part of my postdoctorate here is a matter of trying to attach equations and more mathematical rigor to the ecological work and the flaky ideas that I have.
Hello, my name is Catherine Crawley, and I'm the communications coordinator here at NIMBUS. And I'll be moderating the chat toward the end of the webinar today. So get ready with your questions, and we'll be going through and reading out the questions and responding to them.
So this is Lou Gross back, and I'm going to do a quick summary of the format for this. We will be spending approximately the next 30 to 35 minutes going over some of our ideas related to this topic. And as Catherine said, she will be moderating. Feel free to send text messages through the chat button, which we will then attempt to address at the end. Although this is scheduled to end at 1:45, we are happy to stay online till at least 2 o'clock. If those of you who need to leave, of course, are welcome to leave. Evaluation of this will also occur through an email sent to you if you are participating, and that email will come from our evaluation coordinator here, Pam Bishop. So we would appreciate if you did respond to that evaluation. Also, if you are attending this and you did not register, we would really appreciate to know that who you are. And so if you would send an email to Catherine Crowley at nimbus.org. Just go to nimbus.org and you will find her website, nimbios.org, and her email address is ccrawley at nimbus.org. The resources site for this has a variety of links to information. It also has podcasts from two of the students who participated in this, and we'll be telling you a bit about that student participation, but we did not make those podcasts part of this webinar, but they are linked there, and I encourage you to go and listen to the comments of the students about this issue. So we are now ready to move on to the main portion of this. And first of all, I need to say something about NIMBUS. This is a unique collaboration between the National Science Foundation, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security that fosters collaborative efforts at the interface between mathematics and biology on both fundamental questions in the life sciences and issues that are of application. We have a particular interest in animal infectious disease due to our co-sponsors, Homeland Security and the USDA. But we also have a wide variety of programs that are an attempt to encourage a broader public appreciation of the importance of mathematics in the life sciences, as well as to encourage the development of cadre of researchers who feel comfortable and have intuition both in biology and in mathematics. We have a variety of methods that we use here that are common to many of the NSF bio synthesis centers, including a set of working groups, which are 10 to 15 individuals of focused on a particular topic, as well as investigative workshops that are broader in scope, and a whole set of tutorials that are generally oriented towards encouraging life scientists to learn about and develop their own skills in certain areas of mathematics and computational science. And we have a wide variety of education linked to research activities, as well as postdoctoral fellowships and sabbaticals. NIMBUS is community-driven. That means that I and the other leadership team do not decide what is going on here. It is driven by a set of requests from you, the community, and evaluated by an external advisory board as to what we do. So as an overview of this webinar, I'm going to start out saying something about science, models, and mathematics, and say something briefly about recent reports on biology education. Will is then going to go on and describe our research experience for undergraduates program, and a particular aspect of that program that he led this past summer that will say something about undergraduates, large data sets, and how this links to citizen science projects and mathematics. So that's our overview. The first thing, and I see that somebody has already sent in a question about what is science. This is my favorite definition. This is from Lewis Thomas. It was published in an unusual place, the Sierra Club Bulletin. Science is thought to be a process of pure reductionism, taking the meaning out of mystery, explaining everything away, concentrating all our attention on measuring things and counting them up. It is not like this at all. A scientific method is guesswork, the making up of stories. The difference between this and other imaginative works of the human mind is that science is then obliged to find out whether the guesses are correct, the stories true. Curiosity drives the enterprise and the open acknowledgement of ignorance. So this definition of science has a couple of components that are particularly relevant to our topic today. The first is that the stories in science are our models, how we describe how the world works. And those models obviously include some aspects of the real world and do not include others. For me, the process of modeling is the process of selective ignorance, selectively deciding what to include in our stories about how the world works and what to exclude. At the same time, it also deals with data. Data are necessary to find out whether indeed our guesses about the stories we tell are correct, are indeed in line with the observations and what we can perceive about how the world works. Now, with regard to mathematics and education, I would argue that the student comprehension of mathematics is enhanced if we encourage connections between the mathematics and the models, some of which we construct ourselves, as well as those that we use to understand scientific processes in general, and make the connections to the data that students collect from their own observations of the world around them. And I encourage you in thinking about how to modify your own education and the education of those that you are assisting in their own route to learning about science, that you connect data to mathematical approaches and ways to think about how to link data to a what we call a computational worldview. And linking that to everyday experience is very important. So there is, of course, a lot of background in the education literature about how to effectively do this. And this list of topics is taken from the Bio 2010 report. There's a link to that on the resources page. This is a set of concepts that I and others involved in the Bio 2010 report felt were important for all undergraduates to be exposed to and to comprehend the basics of. And the bolded topics here are ones that are particularly linked to the discussion of today. In other words, the example that you'll be hearing about from Will Godso is indeed an example that ties together modeling, data and measurement, visualization, and the notion of algorithms. Now, there's the Bio 2010 report came out quite a number of years ago now in 2003. There was a much more recent meeting sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the American Association for the Advancement of Science called Vision and Change in Undergraduate Biology Education. The website for that is visionandchange.org. If you go to that website, you will find a summary of this meeting, and pretty soon there will be a much longer report posted. It's expected in the next month or so. The objective of this gathering was to bring together a wide variety of different individuals involved in undergraduate biology education and to consider how we might best modify and change the way that we encourage learning to go on. And the quantitative components of that were just one component of this gathering. The gathering also introduced a sort of set of overarching and unifying key competencies, and all of the competencies that are were identified there, including the process and nature of science, interdisciplinarity, communication, quantitative competency in science and society, are all related to the topic of this webinar. So if you're interested in more about this, go to visionandchange.org. And you should also be aware that the Ecological Society of America is having a conference in Washington in approximately a month and a week that is focusing on particularly the ecological needs for undergraduate education, as well as the associated general literacy in environmental thinking. The other report I wanted to point out to you is a new one from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and the American Association of Medical Colleges. It's called Scientific Foundations for Future Physicians. This came out about a year ago, and it includes a list of competencies, particularly for entering medical students. So this is designed for how to potentially change pre-med training. The first competency on this is applying quantitative reasoning and appropriate mathematics to describe or explain phenomena in the natural world. And we argue that this report is potentially going to drive changes in the MCATs, as well as changes that are going to go on at all kinds of institutions around the country to meet the needs of training future medical students, and that's going to drive undergraduate education as well. So that's a bit of an overview. We're now going to go on to let Will Godso say his portion of this.
All right. Thank you very much, Lou. So what I'm going to do is talk about a research experience undergraduate program that I helped mentor this past summer. and think about some ways to connect data and connect large data sets and ecological insights. And in particular, I want to focus on three big takeaway messages that seem really apparent in the work that I did, and then give specific examples that come from each of these lessons. And so the first big thing that I found was a useful connection for undergraduates with data is, The first important lesson is that connecting ecological concepts to field data is complex. And this in and of itself can be an exciting and powerful lesson for students, that there's a lot of stuff that's happening out in nature. The next lesson that I want to talk about is that math can make biological ambiguities more concrete. And I'll go through a graphical example of that that the students actually presented to me. And then the final big thing that I want to talk about is that even simple mathematical models can strengthen biological hypotheses. So the project that I was a part of was the Research Experience undergraduate program at here at Nimbus at our Math Biology Institute. The program, as it's set up here, is an 8-week project, so the months of June and July, and it's a fairly large program with 13 undergraduates this year, two high school teachers, and three veterinary students who were recruited from across the country. The large ecological data sets project that I worked on had four students, myself as a mentor, and another mentor, Professor Paul Armsworth, who's a professor here at the University of Tennessee. The students who we had, these are photos of them right here, and we've got Jillian Trask, who was formerly a high school teacher but is just starting graduate school at the University of Tennessee. And then Kelly Geyer, right here, who is a stats major. Sam Marchana, who I'm afraid to say, but I think she's an abstract math major, but I could be wrong about that. And then David Bulger right here, who's a chemistry major. These students were given a project that was based on a data set that was collected in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which is right here on the border between Tennessee and North Carolina. And this, I think, was a real asset for the project, that Great Smoky Mountains National Park is a really exceptional spot to study ecology. It's a region with a large range of elevations from 500 meters up to 2,000 meters, and it's a global biodiversity hotspot. And that means both that there are charismatic animals that people know they should get excited about, things like bears right here, but also that there are lots of other strange, weird animals. So, for example, here I have Plethodon jordani, Jordan salamander, which is an endemic to the high elevation regions of this. Within this park, a group called the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory, which includes both people from the national park and a nonprofit organization, collected a large data set. This data set includes 23 orders of insects, 226 families of insects, nearly 2,000 species of insects, and nearly 200,000 individuals. And these were collected using a variety of insect trapping methods from 11 sites that were distributed in representative habitats throughout the park. And so here's one site here in Caves Cove, for example, which if you've ever been to the park, that's one of the most famous regions in the park. Wow, now I have a blank slide, which I can't even remember exactly what that one is. So we're going to pass on to the next slide then. Sorry for the technical difficulties, people. Yes, and now we're waiting for two more slides that will come up. With this large data set, we started off by giving the students a fairly broad research problem. And the problem was the following. Summarize the large set of observations that were collected in the Smoky Mountains into a few ecological insights. To do this, the first thing we had to do was get them to wade into the complexity of analyzing ecological data, and also to get them excited about this. And the first approach we took to deal with this particular problem was to get the students out into the field. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is about an hour and a bit away from Knoxville, and so we were able to get them to do three distinct field trips to get into the park. On the first field trip, they met up with people from the All Taxon Biodiversity Inventory to collect insects and identify them near Twin Creeks, which is a research station in the park. On a second field trip, which I'm pleased to say the students organized on their own, which I think caused some lessons for them, On that trip, the students went to find some of the field sites that were in the park, where data had been collected in the database. And then the final trip was one that I took with the students, where the students had identified some groups of insects that they'd studied intensely, and we went into the park to see if we could find those particular groups of insects. Once we let the students wade into the field component of dealing with ecological data, the next thing we did was give them relatively well-formatted data. Data sets were relatively easy to analyze. Specifically, there were about 200 files for individual families of insects. And so this right here is a sample of a file from brush-footed butterflies, which is a family of butterflies that's fairly charismatic. And the data sets were basically Excel spreadsheets that included collecting sites. So Andrews Bald is one collecting site, Snake Den Ridge, Twin Creeks, and then the names of individual butterfly species and counts associated with them. And when we'd given these files, we were able to then get the students to run analyses in the programming language R. Many people use R in ecological data, so I won't presume that everyone hasn't heard. I've lost my train of thought. Many people have heard of R. If you haven't, it's certainly worth looking into. It's an open source programming language that's free. It takes a little bit of time to start to learn how to use it effectively, but it's a really useful teaching tool because you can download many packages that allow you to run a large number of statistical analyses on ecological data sets or many other data sets. And there are also a number of resources that are associated with this language. So when we introduced this language to the students, what we did was set up a two-hour lecture that helped walk them through some of the basics of how the R programming language works, and then also had them do a two-hour walkthrough with myself where we would take the pre-formatted data that I'd shown you in the last slide, and then got them to run some basic analyses in Vegan and then other biodiversity analyses. Vegan, by the way, is a package which means it's a group of commands that you can download from R and use that to run many different biodiversity analyses. The students I had took to using this language very well, and it actually meant that pretty soon after they started using this language, the students would get an impression of another aspect of the complexities that arise out of ecological data. The reason for that is that in R or in many other software packages, there are literally hundreds of different analyses you can run on ecological data. And this has a sort of unfortunate consequence that it's often easier to run analyses than it is for students to understand what the analysis actually does. Once you have the basics of R done, there are a lot of commands that you can run in about the same way. And for some of my students, at least, it even got to the point where it would be easier for them to automate the analyses, and so do 200 parallel analyses on individual families than it was to actually get them to, it was easier to automate than it was to actually explain clearly what a particular statistical method is doing. And so once we realize this problem of you're both allowing the students to understand the complexity, but you've also got to sort of bring them back in and make sure that they understand what they're doing, we took a strategy of making them communicate make them explain the analyses that they were doing back to us, which meant that a lot of the times that we met with the students, Paul Arnsworth and myself, we'd spend a lot of that time just getting students to say, okay, you want to run this particular algorithm to estimate the diversity in a particular family of insects. What are the assumptions of that model? How does that model actually work? And rightly or wrongly, one of the things that happened from that is it helped the students see the ambiguities that were coming out of the work that they were doing. We also had another aspect of communication, which also doesn't seem to be showing up right now. So I'm just going to tell you what's in this slide here, which is that we got the people in the park to, there we go. I made the mistake of not pressing a button, pardon me. We also fostered interactions between the students and the National Park Service, who had actually done some of the collection of this data initially. And this was really important because, let me back up a little bit. What we first did was get the students to meet with people such as Keith Langdon, the guy in green and tan here, who had collected some of the original data, and the students met with him at the beginning of their project, and then and when we met, we discussed things like the fact that they might understand an analysis and be able to implement it in R, but they wouldn't be able to, they'd also have to ultimately explain what they were doing to parks service people and managers. And there we go. And so that, and then the other way that the students communicated with the park was that at the very end of their project, they did a final presentation where park service people were there. And what this meant was both that they would get a feeling of the complexity that's inherent in ecological data, but also that they were forced to take that complexity and find a way to simplify it down to where you could talk to non-specialists. And what this process ultimately resulted in was that we were able to get the students to take down the many, many possible analyses that you can run on a large ecological data set, and then simplify those down to a couple of big overarching questions that they tackle. And so the first question that the students, question number one that the students tackled was, what are the major components of diversity within the All Taxon Biodiversity data set? Deceptively simple question. There are many ways that we can talk about diversity within a data set, but I'm going to give you one example of some mathematics that the students used to clarify one particular component, to clarify one particular idea about diversity, which is how different are the insect communities that are present in distinct sites in the Smoky Mountains. The second question that the students asked was the data that they had collected consistent with previous observations that people had made within Great Smoky Mountains National Park? And I'm going to show you another simple example of a mathematical model that the students used to ask whether particular groups of insects are more abundant in wet sites. So let's start with the first question, which is how different are the insect communities in each site? And what I'm going to show you is a very simple mathematical model with a graphical interpretation that you can use to think about diversity and differences in insect communities from one to another. This is work that Samar Chenna, one of the students, came up with early on in the course of this 8-week project, where I'd given a couple of the students a paper to read and summarize, which is Legendre and Gallagher 2001, which is a summary of different ways to measure similarity between communities, and we have the reference for that on our webpage. And then from that, Samar Chenna developed an intuitive explanation of why there are different ways to measure diversity, which is based on an older paper. And we also have a link to that older paper, or Loki 1967, on the webpage. And so this is sort of the simple graphical model that I was talking about. So let's think about the diversity. Let's think about different sites within the Smoky Mountains National Park. And let's say, for the sake of simplicity, that in each of those sites, we can measure the abundance of only two species, so that we can draw pictures of what we care about. And so we'll have the abundance of one species, species one up here, a butterfly, and then the abundance of another species, this beetle right here, species two. Now let's imagine two sites that are very different. And so I'm imagining a site, two sites, one that's a mountain, and one that's a desert. Obviously, a greater range of variation than what we actually get in the Smoky Mountains. In these two sites, let's make them as different as possible, which means that one site will have only individuals of species one, the other site will only have individuals of species two. And so I'm going to draw that with two arrows on this plot. So site one only has species one, site two only has species two right here. Now we can start to ask, how dissimilar are the communities of insects that are in these sites? And one familiar mathematical way to think about this question of how dissimilar are these two sites is just to ask how far apart on this graph are the sites, which means calculating the distance, this right here, between this point and this point, like that. And this is something that's familiar mathematically. If you want to get into the details, it's just a matter of calculating Euclidean distance. But this measure that seems intuitive has a problem, and I can show you that problem by thinking about another set of sites. Let's say we have site 3 and site 4, and each of these sites contains individuals of both insect species. So site 3 right here has individuals of species 1, and it has individuals of species 2. Site 4, over here, has individuals of species 1 and individuals of species 2. But even though both sites 3 and site 4 have individuals of both species, you can compare the measure of distance between the two sites, which is what I've done here. So we have this distance from site 3 to site 4. And this distance is actually quite a bit longer than the distance between site 1 and site 2. And so even though site 1 and site 2 don't share any of the species of insects, the distance between them is much shorter. And this is a problem that people have thought about for a while, and there are many that an intuitive measure seems a little bit off. And one possible solution that you can use to deal with this problem is to say that you don't care about the total number of each insect species within each site, so you don't care that there are a large number of insects in site 3 and a large number of insects in site 4. All you care about is the relative abundance of the insects. And so you've got this site that only has species 1, this site that has many individuals of species 1 and some of species 2, this site that has many individuals of both species, and this site that only has individuals of species 2. And then you can compare only the relative abundance of the two sites, which is what you've got here. So you have each of these arrows is now the same length, but the relative abundance is different. And when you do that, you're computing what's called chord distance instead of Euclidean distance. And that's another biologically reasonable way to think about the difference between each of the sites of insects. But it's a measure that has different properties from Euclidean distance. And it isn't a simple matter that one measure is right and the other measure is wrong. Euclidean distance, the measure over here, is one that takes into account of abundance. You might really care about abundance. And whereas chord distance is a measure that only cares about the relative abundance of each species. And so this is just an example of when you go through the mathematics, thinking about the similarity between each site, the math can make ambiguities more concrete, where what seems like a simple problem becomes much more complex as you actually go through and work through how to make calculations. And then the next example I wanted to talk about is how math can improve hypothesis testing. And this is a really important point in large data sets for the following reason. A data set like the one that we were working on in Great Smoky Mountains National Park is really charismatic and really interesting. If you get students interested in one organism, let's say beetles, like this longhorn beetle right here, it's easy to imagine that the diversity and abundance of this group of beetles might depend on other insects, things like predators like dragonflies. They might think that it depends on the abundance of plants, things like this milkweed, which is a host plant for this group of longhorn beetles. Or they might think it's a matter of anything else in the environment in the Smokies. And so there are many possible ideas that students may want to test. But with the data set that we had, we only had 11 sites. And that means from a statistical point of view, you really only have 11 replicates or 11 independent pieces of information for a lot of the questions that we're interested in testing. And so given that fact, there's not really enough information to test many distinct hypotheses with the data set. And if you want to make a reliable statistical test, you often have to pool some of your observations to test your hypothesis. And another way to think of that is that sort of basic statistical theory provides limits on the hypotheses that you can test with the data with a large data set. And so this is a problem that my students came up with very quickly, that there were many ideas they wanted to examine. And the way we tried to get around this problem was to ask a much more focused, much more narrow question. And that was whether the observations that were collected in the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory, the large data set we were working with, whether those observations were consistent with previous observations that had been made in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. We were really lucky in this regard that there's actually been some seminal work on quantitative ecology that had previously been done in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So Bob Whitaker, who is a well-known quantitative ecologist, did part of his doctorate in the park, and he published a paper in the early 1950s, which is this long quantitative description of the diversity and abundance of different insect groups within the park. And he made lots of observations from the data that he collected, and one of them was that some families of insects are more abundant in wet locations than in dry locations, and he defines wet and dry in that term for his vegetation classification. And it turned out that because of the way that the data was collected in the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory project, we could also find sort of a parallel characterization of sites, where there were some sites that were wet and some sites that were dry. And with the data set that we had, it was possible to use that information to pull out two numbers from our database. So a total number of insects collected in one family across all sites, and then, which I'm going to call N from now on, and then K, which is the number of insects in that family collected in wet sites. And so you've got these two numbers here. And Kelly Geyer, who is one of the students working on this project, came up with both a very intuitive, I think, and also a fairly simple mathematical model. So the model that she developed is to assume that that an insect that is collected is equally likely to be from any site. And with that, you've got an insect here, and you can go through the list of sites that are in our database, and it turns out that there are 6 sites that are characterized as wet, and 5 sites that are characterized as dry. And so you can then compute the probabilities that a given insect would be found in a wet site, and that'll be 6/11. So the chance that it'll be in one of the 6 wet sites instead of one of the 5 dry sites. With that information, you can now set up a simple statistical model, which is a model based on a binomial distribution. So this is a model that needs 3 pieces of information. You have N, which is the total number of things that happen, K, which is the number of successes, and in this case, a success is where an insect is found in a wet site rather than a dry site, and then P, which is the expected probability that an insect will be wet. And with this, you can generate a hypothesis test. By doing this statistical analysis, you change what you're considering replicates. So statistical replicates in this analysis are now individual insects, not sites. And as a result, the test is very powerful. And it turned out that many of the observations made by Whitaker were inconsistent with the observations that were made in the ATB database. And so with that, that was sort of the second mathematical example I wanted to go through. And I now want to wrap up with just sort of a couple of big points. One is that linking models with data is a fundamental scientific skill, and life science curricula are going to increasingly emphasize quantitative approaches, which we're trying to develop here at NIMS. Large ecological data sets, like the ones that my students worked on, are really valuable because they can help teach a couple of general quantitative lessons. The first lesson that I think my students really, really got out of this project and sort of reinforced this for me as well is that fieldwork and analyses force students to experience complex biological problems. The next concept that I think my students got out of this is that mathematical calculations can make ambiguities more concrete. And the final one is that even simple mathematical models can strengthen hypothesis tests. And so with that, I would like to say thanks to a number of people, most of it particularly Sam Rachana, David, Jillian, and Kelly, the students who worked on this project. Also, Dr. Paul Armsworth, who was the other mentor and very valuable for this project, Nathan Sanders and Suzanne Lenhart, who provided valuable help for this as well. And that concludes the formal part of the presentation, and I think we can start getting ready for questions.
Okay, well, it looks like we have one question that occurred a little while back, and the question was from Ermi, did the students participate in collecting the data set? Seemingly, it is a large data set. I suppose this data set is already available.
Thank you, Catherine. So the students couldn't collect this data set in its entirety here. And I think that in the one hand, that's sort of unfortunate. But on the other hand, given the short timescale of this project, that was not... It's just as well that they couldn't do the formal insect identification. what I tried to do instead of getting them to collect the data was to sort of simulate the effect of collecting ecological data sets. So they went out with parks staff and obtained some data on insects that were attacking trees at the Twin Creeks, which is a site within the park. That was not data that they ultimately analyzed, but it will go into the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory data set at some point. The other thing I tried to do was to give them a feel of natural history work. And so if you go to the audio, you'll hear Jillian, who talks about how I foisted a book on tree identification on her, and she started identifying a hickory she identified a hickory tree that was in her backyard. And I took the students out on a field trip where we looked for 11 distinct families of insects that they'd done particular analyses on. So I think that's my answer for that.
Okay, we have another question. Several other questions. Okay, Jeff asks, can you envision a smaller scale version of a project like this, one that would fit within a course in a unit in a course, for example, 2 to 4 weeks? How would you structure that?
Okay, so if I were to, I think that there are a lot of things in this project that could be shrunken down. I'll start with a general example of that, and then I'll try to come back with how I'd envision structuring this. So as I said before, one of the things that happens when you have a very large database is that there's a really strong temptation for students to just chug through the numbers. So you can, once you figure out how to do summary statistics on the longhorn beetles or the brush-footed butterflies, there's no reason why you can't apply the same method to another group. And so in some ways, the large data set is both helpful because it means that students have a lot that they can do, but also a curse that it means that it's harder to focus in on the particular biology of a question. So if I were if I had the same scenario of the All Taxa Biodiversity Inventory database and I wanted to compress it down to 4 weeks, there are two big things that I would envision cutting out. The first is that a lot of the time that the students spent was figuring out how to refine the questions that they were asking. And so there were multiple versions of the biological questions that they were interested in investigating before they got to sort of the two neat-ish questions that I presented of what are the components of diversity and is their data set consistent with Whitaker's work. So that's the first thing I do, is that I think that's really valuable to get students to figure out questions on their own. But in a shorter time frame, I think that it would be more valuable just to focus on the technical aspects of the project of calculating summary statistics. The other thing that I would have done is focus on a few families with compelling natural history stories. So brush-footed butterflies, you can read a field guide and find out interesting information about different butterfly species, or bees, or I have a soft spot for predatory wasps, so something like that. So take a small number of families with data sets that are basically just a single Excel spreadsheet and try to learn as much as possible about those families. And then if the students get the skills for that under their belt, then try to replicate analyses that work well in that family on additional families.
And I'll add something on this too. Obviously, with regard to very large data sets, the National Science Foundation has a new project called NEON, the National Ecological Observatory Network, that is coming online and will produce immense amounts of data that will be available online. If you go to neon.org, you will find a variety of information there about their plans on the educational end of it. But I'd also like to point out that it's possible to do small data set collections in class settings, and as an example of that, I have for years taught a Mathematics for the Life Sciences course, and one of the things that I found very useful to do is to encourage them to collect data on themselves. So one of the simplest examples that I do right at the beginning of this course is to ask them, this is a large class of 200 students, ask them what happens to their height overnight, and they produce a set of hypotheses about what happens to their height overnight. We then have them each collect data for 4 nights on their height, pool it. So it's not a a really large data set, but it's certainly something that has on the order of 1,000 data points, and then assess that in a class format using a variety of quantitative tools to determine whether indeed the height does change overnight and whether or not it's related to issues such as gender or how much sleep they had. So it's entirely possible to do these kinds of things even if you don't have access to biodiversity data, although there are lots of ATBI projects going on around the country.
Can we have a kind of a follow-up question to talking about the data set? What did the original data set look like, and how did you reformat that?
Okay, so the Altaxa Biodiversity Inventory, I hope I can get the names of all the file types straight in my head, but if you go to their website, they have a list of observations, and I'm pretty sure we have a link to their website through our homepage. And what I originally got was a large database file that had many tables and was rather unwieldy to work with. And so the first thing that I had to do, which originally was for myself to be able to analyze data on my own, was to take that database file and convert it into a very long spreadsheet, basically. And that spreadsheet had, I think, about 200,000 rows on it and many dozens of columns. And originally, I didn't plan to give that to the students, and I just gave them the smaller breakdowns that had only the 11 sites and then all the species within a family. It turned out, though, that David, one of the students, was very interested in learning how to program in R, and I ultimately gave him a copy of the big data set, and he could pull out summary statistics from that on his own.
Okay, we have somebody would like to see the summary slide again. This is the second to last slide, so we'll make sure we get that put up.
I think that's it.
And can you mention, again, Will, the name of the site where you got the data set?
Oh, it's probably because I said it wrong the first time, didn't I? So it's the Altaxa Biodiversity Inventory. Have I said it right at that time? And the link for that is through our links webpage. We have I believe we have a link to that, or if not, we'll have that shortly.
Yeah. So the organization here, which is a nonprofit that collects this, is Discover Life in America, and you can go to discoverlifeinamerica.org to see some of the details of the citizen science component of this. The piece that Will was talking about is only one small part of a much larger data set, much of which has been collected through citizen science activity.
Okay, and we have a question from Barbara. Are you looking for large ecological data sets to work with? Barbara works with the Forest Service Research, and they are looking for ways to share their long-term data sets with educators in useful ways.
Lou, do you want to take that?
Sure. So I think that this is exactly one of the things that we wanted to foster with this webinar and that the Ecological Society of America wants to foster with regard to a variety of projects that they have. There is what's called the Biological Education Network that the Ecological Society of America is part of, and we want to assist in collecting appropriate data that might be utilized for projects like this. So I will encourage Barbara and anyone else who has access to those data to contact either me here at Nimbus or to contact the education coordinator for the Ecological Society of America, who's Teresa Murad, and I'm sure that she will also put you in contact with the people in the Ecological Society who are doing the online collection of not just data sets, but teaching tools that are useful in ecology education at all levels.
Are there any other questions out there? I don't see any more questions on the chat at the moment, and we have just run over the 45 minutes allotted time. Do we have a few more minutes left for questions?
Well, we have time if there are any.
Okay. We have a just one more question. Is it possible to include my email address in the listserv, since I think this, let's see.
Yeah, if you just, if you send your email address and you don't mind us publicly posting it, we can do that. But if you prefer, we could just send it to those who we had who are participating in this. Just let us know, and we'll be happy to do that.
And another question, when will the webinar be available in the archive? Good question.
Excellent question. As soon as we figure it out?
As soon as we get the audio part edited down, we'll be posting it. But we will post the PowerPoint slides immediately. They'll be posted this afternoon. Okay, well, I'm not seeing any other questions. If there's nothing else coming in, we really appreciate your participation in this. And I again encourage you that if you are on this and you did not register, if you would just let us know who you are by sending an email to C. Crowley, C-C-R-A-W-L-E-Y, at nimbios.org, that would be great. And also, you will be getting an evaluation of this webinar from our evaluation coordinator, Pam Bishop, and we'd appreciate you returning that. And unless there's another question, I think that that's it. So we thank you very much for your participation, and hope that you will come and view the variety of things we have going on both here at Nimbus and at the Ecological Society of America, ESA.org. Thanks a lot. Bye.